Great. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for the introduction and for your prayers. Really good to be here and to continue this series in Revelation. Some of you, if you haven't been here before, we're going through the book of Revelation. It's obviously quite an ambitious project, and we're looking at quite a few different chapters today. So we're going to get a bit of a kind of overview and draw out some of the main and really key messages that Revelation is meant to communicate to us. So we're going to be looking at chapters 6 to 9 today. And what we're going to do, actually, is kind of instead of one reading, I'm going to just actually pick a few different bits of these four chapters, which we're going to kind of read together. So you need to listen quite carefully to where we are, because we're going to jump about a little bit. And what I'd like to do is everyone could have your Bibles open in front of you, or the open in your phones, in your apps, or in your browsers. And we're going to read one verse each. So the idea is I'll kind of read a verse, and then everybody can read the next verse. And then I'll read et cetera, et cetera. That makes sense? Yeah, don't worry if it doesn't work. We'll stumble along, but I'm sure we will get through it. So we're going to look at a little bit from different sections of here. So first of all, we're just going to be looking at chapter 6, the very beginning, if we look down here. We're going to read from verse 1 just up to the end of verse 8. Okay, so that's going to be our first little section. This is all about the seal. So I'll start with verse 1. It says this, I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come.
And there before me was the white horse. His rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest.
When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come.
Then another horse came out, a fiery great one. His rider was given power to save beasts from the earth and to make people kill each other. To him was given a large sword.
When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come. I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand.
Then I heard what sounded like a voice from among the four living creatures saying, a kilogram of wheat for a day's wages, and 3 kilograms of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine.
When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come.
I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death. And Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a quarter of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth.
Great. And then we're going to just turn over the page, just jump forward a little bit to chapter 7. And then we're just going to read from verses 1 to 10 of chapter 7. So I'll just kick off. Verse 1. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree.
Then I saw another angel coming up from the east, carrying the seal of the living God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels, giving them power to harm the land and the sea, and to
do not harm the land or the sea or the trees, until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God.
Then I heard the number of those with the seals, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel.
From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000.
From the tribe of Asher, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000.
From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000.
From the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000.
After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands.
and they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb."
And then our final bit is just to skip across to over the page to chapter 8. And I just want to read very quickly, so we get just to this from verse 6. And we're only going to go up to, I think, the end of verse 13 here. So starting at verse 6 of chapter 8. Then the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to sound them. The second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turned into blood. The third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star, blazing like a torch, fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water.
The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the water turned bitter, and many people died in the waters that had become bitter.
The fourth angel sounded his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of them turned dark. A third of the day was without light, and also a third of the night. As I watched,
I heard an eagle flying in the air, called out in a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, because the trumpet blasts are about to be sounded by one of the three angels."
Good, I think we'll leave it there. So we've got a little bit of a taster of what's happening in these few chapters. Not easy stuff, but we're going to try and break it up a little bit by thinking about it in sort of three sections, three parts. We're going to talk a bit about the past, a bit about the present, our present today, and about the future as well, what is to come. Let's just begin by introducing this by thinking about the present. And where are you now today? Who are you as you come here? I know many of you well, some of you perhaps not so well, but we can probably say for certain that there are things going on in your life today. Different things that you are maybe struggling with, different challenges that you face, whether that might be a physical challenge or perhaps a mental challenge or an emotional challenge. Maybe it's relational, maybe it's spiritual. Even if your life is absolutely perfect today, we can pretty much guarantee that at some point in the future you're going to run into some kind of difficulties in your life. But one of the key things of Revelation is that it is designed as a book to encourage us. It speaks to us as people who are going through many challenges and who face different pressures in our life today, as well as believers in the time to come. If we remember, if we flip back right to the beginning of Revelation, what does it say at the very start in chapter 1? It says, chapter 1, verse 3, "Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near." We've just read aloud some of those words. We're going to be thinking about some other words that we didn't necessarily just read out loud. But there is a blessing there for us if we take to heart what is written in it. So whoever you are today, there is something for you to take to heart that God is going to encourage you with as we consider, as we reflect on and digest these words that God has given us. Remember, these words are meant to be like food to us. I'm going to start, though, with a little discussion question, just to get you talking on your tables. It's quite a light-hearted one. I want you to imagine that you are a film producer. You are entering into the movie business, and you have been tasked with producing a film of the book of Revelation. Some people have attempted this before. There's a few different kind of films out there in different genres of different quality. And your decision, though, is who are you going to cast in your film? I'd like you to think, who would be your leading actor or leading actress? However you want to imagine what sort of narrative you're going to construct for this. Who would you cast in a film of Revelation and why? Just take about 3 minutes to have a discussion of this on your table and try and think particularly about why you would cast that person in the film of Revelation. Well, yeah, it is actually an interesting picture, and I think it's good that you pointed out this sort of picture of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, although you haven't sort of coloured the horses in there. That is actually probably, isn't it, how Revelation is often depicted, or the idea of apocalypse. in particular, is depicted in films, isn't it? A lot of the films, if they're not sort of Christian-themed films, they talk about the end of the world, and it's usually a sort of horror film, isn't it? That's the way. It looks like this. It's kind of a horror film, some sort of stalking horror that's pursuing the main lead character, and they have to kind of defeat them. And this is sort of the way they think about apocalypse. But actually, of course, Revelation, is it really a horror film? It's not actually, is it really? That's not really the point. That Revelation is not a horror film. For believers, it's not intended to instill us with a sense of horror. As we saw at the beginning of chapter 1, that actually it's meant to bless us and edify us. That's the purpose of the book of Revelation. So it's interesting what kind of actors would suit a film that is encouraging and edifying. Maybe Dominic was kind of getting along the right lines, although they make rom-coms not actually that edifying, perhaps, really kind of at all there. But yeah, so as we come particularly to these sort of chapters, which are full of certainly horrific events, it's important to remember that the purpose, though, is not for us to instill a sense of horror, but actually for us to be edified and encouraged by what we read. These chapters are sort of, I'm going to handle them a little bit sort of in three parts. So in terms of events, you've got sort of chapter 6, and we looked a little bit at those, these six seals. And then the seventh seal, there's sort of a pause, and the seventh seal is then sort of in chapter 8, where you get then the sixth of the seven trumpets, and in between them, sort of sandwiched in between, and I would suggest actually kind of probably meant to be the pinnacle, meant to be what these are sort of pointing to, is this vision then, chapter 7, of 144,000, the great multitude. This is kind of the crescendo, the key point, the sort of chiasm perhaps of this section here. That it's really focusing on what is it saying about this wonderful future. And it's this future that I think is actually so important for us to hold on to. You know, they say to athletes, particularly runners, that they talk about visualization. They have to imagine themselves winning the race. So when they're there at the beginning and they're in their blocks and they're crouching, they're not actually thinking of the start, they're thinking of the finish. They're trying to imagine themselves winning. And by doing that, the idea is that they will spur themselves on to run as hard as they can, to continue pressing on and believe that they can win until they get to the finish line. And that's perhaps a bit of an analogy, that in a similar way, I think what Revelation is maybe doing, particularly in those sort of sections like chapter 7, is giving us a picture that we're meant to hold on to, a picture that helps us keep running until we get to the finish line. And we'll think about that in a lot more detail during this talk. I'm going to set a bit of a scene. We're going to think now about the past of these three parts, past, present, and future. We're going to think about the past, and in particular, Revelation's first hearers. Always important to keep this in mind. Who was Revelation first written for? Who was John writing to? Well, we don't know exactly when it was written, around about probably the end of the first century, maybe. And the Emperor Domitian was the emperor, the Roman emperor at this time. So he was the guy who had all of the power over this region of what is now Turkey. It was part of the Roman Empire, very key central part of the Roman Empire, one of the most prosperous parts. The thing about Domitian was that Domitian was really keen on going back to the Roman traditions, in particular the civic cult. Now this was the idea, was that Rome and its emperors itself were gods and should be worshipped. And actually, one of the first things he did when he came to power was he made his brother, Titus, who'd been emperor before him, he made him a god. He declared that Titus should be worshipped by all citizens, by all people in Rome, as a god. Now, Titus was a very interesting character, particularly if you were Christian or Jewish. Because Titus, before he became emperor, had been a general. And he was the very general who led the Roman army into Jerusalem and destroyed the city, obliterated and set fire to the temple. That was Titus in person who did that. And just a few decades later, his brother declared him a god. Can you imagine how you would feel as a Jewish person, as a Christian, that Titus, the one who had desecrated God's temple, was now being proclaimed to be a god? And also, much later, the historians like Eusebius, the church historians, tell us that towards the end of his reign, Domitian introduced a lot of persecution that focused on Christians and Jews. So generally speaking, a chapter was opening in history where it was not easy to be a Christian. far harder than we generally experience today in this country, when a Christian was something that you could pay with your life, with your freedom, with your liberty. What about today's hearers? What about us then? Perhaps we face pressures to conform. We're not under pressure to worship an emperor, but we are under pressure to conform to certain expectations that come from on high, that come from our government, from the powers that be, that we should socially, culturally conform to what they want. We face perhaps not outright persecution, but maybe some ridicule. Certainly other parts of the world, people face very severe persecution, where they, just like the first hearers, would perhaps be paying for it with their lives. Even if that's not us, we all face, as I mentioned at the beginning, some suffering, some difficulties. So don't imagine that our situation is perhaps so totally far removed from the first hearers of this book of Revelation. What do we think, though? Past, future, and present. Where is your focus today? Some people maybe like hearing a bit of that history. To some people, history is very, very boring, very, very dull. Do you consider yourself to be someone who likes to think about, to focus, to orientate yourself around the past? Or are you someone who likes to live in the moment? Or are you someone who likes to always look to the future? It's another table discussion question. You just want to turn to the people around the table and have a think. Do you see yourself as someone who looks mostly to the past, or to the present in life, or to the future? What do you think is the best way? Is it just a matter of personality? How should we be? So I'll give you again just about 3 minutes just to quickly discuss this, and then we'll share our answers. Great. Okay, that's very good. Yes, great. Sometimes difference in personalities, some of the different life phases and things, isn't it? And there is an element in which we have to be aware of all of these things, sort of aware of your past and your future and your present. And there is actually, in a sense, we see all of these kind of things in this sort of passage. There is one thing, I think, which is that sense of planning for the future, being aware of the future, and having a sort of future vision to kind of spur you on. In a sense, if we have no future vision at all, then it's quite hard, isn't it, to kind of keep going. And so perhaps this is one sense, again, that this in Revelation, that it is setting out this great, glorious vision for a future, which should spur us, encourage us, and help us to keep going. Even if we're young in life or old in this life, for everyone who believes in Jesus, that's the same future that we can look forward to here. So we're going to think a bit about that future now, specifically in this section of the talk, to get a bit more into the text now. So if we look down chapter 6, we thought about these seals, and we don't have time to look at any of them in particular detail, but it says in verse 1, I watched as the Lamb, that's Jesus, opened the first of the seven seals. And as he does this, each seal seems to reveal something slightly different. Some of these seals are judgments, it appears to be, judgments in particular on the earth. Some of them reveal a particular picture. So if we have a look down, it says, first of all, it says in verse 1, I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its a rider held a bow, and he was given a crown. He rode out as a conqueror, bent on conquest. So the first one of these are four horsemen of the apocalypse here. It seems to be a figure of a conqueror, someone who is bent on conquest. And then it goes on to the second living creature. And then another horse, a red horse. And this one then it says power to kill each other. Jonathan was talking this morning about the areas in the world in which we see different conflicts going on. We see how incredible, how quickly that conflict can escalate and can rapidly multiply. The third seal, then a black horse holding scales in its hand. And there's this bit here about payments of things. What it seems to be suggesting is a kilogram of wheat for a day's wages. It's something sort of subsistence living. A kilogram of wheat is kind of one person's ration for a day. And so it's like a day's wages for one person's quantity of food. So you're kind of basically, imagine you're a family, you have to live on one person's basic kind of rations. And then we're sort of moving on very rapidly, but then to the fourth seal, the fourth living creature, a pale horse that is named Death, with Hades following behind. This seems to be then a very severe judgment. It says power over a quarter of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. The fifth seal is then completely different. This then picture of the souls under the altar. These are those who have been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they've maintained. We're talking there, we're thinking about what happened during the missions reign and the pressure that some Christians were facing even in losing their life. And they call out, "How long, O Lord, how long until you avenge our blood?" in verse 10. And they have to wait in verse 11 a little longer until the full number of their fellow servants were killed just as they had been. And then the sixth seal brings then back to a picture of judgment. There was a great earthquake, the sun turning black, the stars falling down, sort of cosmic disintegration, dramatic picture. And then in verse 15 onwards, it talks about the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, calling out to the mountains and the rocks to fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. This seems to be now talking very much about a picture of God's judgment, maybe the final judgment here. So this is a very complex picture that's unfolding. Is this something that happens sequentially? People have different views on whether these things are happening one after another. Maybe there's something that we kind of see happening through time, a sort of pattern through history. Certainly we can see examples of these things having happened in the past, of wars, earthquakes, destruction, famine, these things following one after the other. Maybe a sense like a sort of spiral staircase that gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it reaches its final crescendo here. How these things then fit together with the trumpets in chapter 8 and 9. Again, is it sequential? Is it a bit like a film? Is this a picture of the same events from a different angle? Or is it one thing falling after another? Different views on that. But one thing I want to draw, one sort of comparison here, is to think about the book of Exodus. Now, if you go back there, this series of judgments should resonate very much with what we read there. You remember what happened? How were the Israelites freed from Egypt? Well, God inflicted a series of plagues upon Egypt. And actually, some of the symbolism is very, very similar, particularly with these trumpets in verses 8 and 9. I'll talk about those in a sec. Jewish thought in particular tended to look for patterns, tend to look for resonances between events. And I think it's quite clear between Exodus and these judgments. Let's think about how this works. Do you remember back in the Old Testament that at that time that Israel had a prophecy? They had the promises that God had given to Abraham, that he would make them into a nation, that he would give them this promised land, and many other things too. And they were wondering, you know, how is this going to be fulfilled when they're in slavery in Egypt? How is this ever going to actually come about? Well, the way that God does it, the way that God freed them from Egypt, was via a series of plagues, a series of judgments. How were they delivered? They were free from slavery. I remember it was by the marking of the blood of a lamb, the lamb on the doorpost. And they came into a new life, a promised land for the faithful. Actually, it wasn't the generation who left Egypt. It was actually the next generation, the ones who actually trusted God and remained faithful, entered into this new life. So where are the parallels here? I think there's quite a few, just to do this very briefly. What's the prophecy that we have here? Well, we have, for example, in Revelation, we have the words of this book. That's the prophecy that we've been given. There's a judgment, there's the seals, the trumpets, later on, much later on, looking at that today, the bowls, the spirit of God's judgments on the earth, and deliverance, again, through the blood of the Lamb. Strong echoes of Exodus here. And what's the point of new life? That we don't enter a literal, physical promised land here, but we enter an eternal kingdom that is, again, for the faithful. So again, it's those who trust in God who enter into this new life, this new kingdom. Strong wrong resonances here. Let's skip actually just looking quickly at these seven trumpets. What's going on here in chapters 8 and 9? I need again to know, like, does this follow after the seals in time? Is it another way of talking about the same events that are happening here? If we just look down, they seem to kind of follow on from the seventh seal that kind of then opens up these trumpets. In chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "He opened the seventh seal, and there was silence in heaven for half an hour, and I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them." If we go on to verse 6, the seven trumpets then prepared to sound them. And verse 7, the first angel sounds his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down on the earth. And it says a third, as we read, of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees, and a third of the green grass. The second angel then sounds his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all the blaze is thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea, note these points of thirds here, turned into blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. And then the third angel sounds his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch falls from the sky on a third of the rivers. And verse 12, the fourth angel sounds his trumpet, and then a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, so a third of them turned dark, a third of the day was without light, and a third of the night. Constant imagery of the thirds. If you go on to chapter 9, the fifth angel sounds his trumpet, and then a star that's fallen, a star falls from sky to the earth. Now, things here appear to become very, very spiritual. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. Very symbolic language. Seems to be talking here about something spiritual, demonic, satanic. And he opens the abyss, and what comes from it? Smoke, and then from it comes this giant plague of locusts that cause massive destruction and injury. And then if we skip on to verse 13, the sixth angel then sounds his trumpet. And then after this, we then see a picture of a crescendo of destruction. They released to kill a third of mankind. This massive, army that seems very strange, this imagery here. That there are horses and riders that have breastplates, the fiery red, dark blue and yellow. The heads of the horses resemble the mouths of lions, and out of their mouths come fire, smoke and sulphur. Very curious, very strong imagery here. Very, very vivid. But the results are devastating. It talks about a third of mankind being killed. But one important point to mention here, I think, is what's this constant reference to thirds here? And maybe one thing to keep in mind is that a third is a minority. It could have been a half. It could have been more. There's two other places in the Old Testament, prophetically, where thirds are mentioned. So one is in the book of Ezekiel. And Ezekiel is told to cut off his hair. Remember, it's a weird sort of prophetic image. And he divides it up into three parts. And one part of it he has to burn. One part of it he has to chop up. And the other part he scatters. And it symbolizes the destruction of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's judgment. Okay, and in that image, the whole city, the whole of the people are destroyed or lost. Whether it's by fire, by sword, or by going into exile. Total destruction, a bit like the flood. If you think back to Genesis, you get the sense of total wipeout, total annihilation. In Zechariah, it then again talks about judgment on Jerusalem. And in Zechariah, he says that two-thirds of the city will perish, and one-third will be spared, and they'll be refined like gold in a fire. Now notice here in Revelation, constant reference to not three-thirds, not two-thirds, but to one-third. So there is a sense perhaps here that it's in a way a mercy that God is now saying that his judgment will fall on a third. It will fall on a third of the people. Not on two-thirds, not on everybody, but on a third. So in a sense it is actually a demonstration of the grace of God. What happens to the two-thirds? What's going on with everybody else, these other two-thirds? Well, actually, they kind of tell us why, or some of the reasons, help to open us a bit of the reasons why these judgments are being visited. Because we might think, this sounds, you know, kind of harsh. Doesn't it sound quite hard to inflict all these things on the people of Earth, the people that, you know, are our neighbours, the people that we know? Well, one of the reasons is given for us in Revelation chapter 8, verse 20. It says, the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues, strong echoes there of Egypt's plagues, still did not repent of the work of their hands. They did not stop worshipping demons and idols of gold, silver, bronze, stone and wood, idols that cannot see or hear or walk. So what's the key purpose of these judgments? It's actually, they're meant to bring people to God. They're meant to bring people to repentance so they don't suffer the far worse punishment of being separated forever from God. And there's again a clear parallel, an analogy with Exodus 7 verse 13. Before God visits the plagues, it says this, that Pharaoh's heart became hard and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. So one of the reasons why the plagues were actually inflicted on Egypt was the stubborn refusal of Pharaoh to let God's people go. Remember, it took 10 plagues before he was willing to do it. And so just as those plagues were like a message to Pharaoh in Egypt that they should be obedient to God and allow the Israelites to go, so these plagues are designed to bring people, the intention is to bring people back to God. But Such is the hardness of heart that mankind does not listen. They don't repent of the things they're doing. They refuse to come back to God. And here's perhaps the other aspect to it as well, maybe. That they're also an answer to prayer and a warning about an end. This little bit is sort of sectioned in between. There's a curious little almost kind of interlude where an angel has the prayers of God's people in a bowl. And then he kind of throws it down to earth. And it says in chapter 8, verse 5, he took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and hurled it on the earth. And there came peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. It's odd, isn't it? It's like the prayers result in the kind of things that we see with the seals and the trumpets. And maybe what this is saying, that in some sense, these seals and trumpets, these judgments, are an answer to the prayers of God's people. Now, we might think that's a bit curious. Why would they be praying for destruction to be visited on the earth? I think perhaps what they're praying for is vindication. They're praying for God's righteous judgment for what they have suffered. Now, maybe we don't quite sort of feel that. We couldn't imagine doing that. But maybe that's because we don't yet in this country suffer in the way that Christians do in other places. I was listening to something on the radio on Premier about the Barnabas Fund, and they were relaying some of the stories just from this last year of persecution around the world and terrible things that have happened in places like Nigeria, where if you can imagine, you know, your family members being taken away and being killed, your children, your brothers and sisters, just because they're Christians. If you live in that kind of environment, then you long for vindication. You long for God's justice to be done. You long for an end to all of this. And all of these things that are happening are pointing to an end that is coming, to a judgment that is actually far more serious even than these seals and these trumpets. But all of this is sort of pointing to, leading up to this time of God's judgment, when God's justice will be done. And on that day, it has two aspects to it. There's that aspect of judgment being visited on sin, but also this wonderful picture in chapter 7. And it's this picture, I think, in chapter 7 that is so vital for us to hold on to. It's that image that the athlete keeps in their mind when they're running the race. This fantastic picture of the 144,000 sealed and the great multitude in white robes. Let me just look down at chapter 7 briefly. I know, sorry, we're a bit over time here. What's going on? What's it talking about? He has this vision. Well, sorry, he doesn't have the vision. He hears. It's very important to note that in verse 4, I heard the number of those who were sealed. It's not something he's seeing, but he's hearing a number of people who are sealed on the earth. And it's 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. Now, there's very much discussion and debate on this as to who are these people. Are they Jewish believers? Are they Jewish evangelists to the world? Is it a picture of Jews and Gentiles? Is it symbolizing the combined church? Whatever it means, there's a sense of completeness. 144,000 is really key here. There are, of course, 12 tribes of Israel, and it's a big multiple that from each tribe of 12, the 12 tribes, you have 12,000. And this is really important. Later on in Revelation, when it talks about the New Jerusalem, it talks about it being 12,000 cubits. The sense is, I think, of it being a complete number. That everybody who should be there is there. It's like the fulfillment of all. Remember back God's promises to Abraham. God's promises to Abraham being fulfilled. That God's people are sealed, and everyone who should be there is actually there. And then in verse 9 it says, after hearing, he then sees. Verse 9 it says, after this I looked. So possibly, maybe, this is talking about the same thing in some way. Remember, as we heard in the last talk, in the last of you were here for that, that he heard about the lion and he saw a lamb. And they were one and the same person, Jesus. Possibly it's the same. It's difficult to say, because the language suggests there might be a section break there in verse 9, after this I looked. But it's very closely connected, I think, that this sense of God's people being there, being present, and being kept safe. And in verse 9, they're not on earth, but they actually seem to be in heaven. Okay, now they're being kept safe in heaven. A great multitude now in verse 9 that no one could count. And who are they? They are from every nation, tribe, people and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. So they're people like you and me, people from all nations now, who are here before God. I'm just going to skip through that bit, I think. And how do they get there? How can we be part of this great multitude? It says in verse 14 that they specifically are those who have come out of the great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Maybe these are the people who have lived through these times it's been talking about here, of the seals. But the key is they get there by this, that they've had their robes washed and made them white, paradoxically, in the blood of the Lamb. Never heard of using blood to make something white, no. Yeah, it's not really like Ariel, is it, or Persil. But they've washed them in blood. And that's how they have the right robes to be there, to be part of God's people, in this wonderful, wonderful image of fellowship with God before the throne in which the Father sits and before the Lamb. And what do they call out? They cry out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." They're worshipping the God of creation. And what else does it say? And I think this is also very key to understanding how this future picture can encourage us and spur us. No matter what you're going through at the moment, whether it's physical, emotional, spiritual, relational, no matter what you might be facing very soon, that in some way, in God's working, that this eternal picture heals and makes up for everything that we've gone through in this life, whatever it might be, even if it was as severe as perhaps martyrdom. Put the words up here from Revelation 7, verse 15. "They are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. Never again will they hunger. Never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat down on them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." Isn't that a beautiful picture of having tears wiped away from your eyes? There's an invitation there. Maybe you aren't someone who's had their clothes washed by Jesus' blood. It's a complex image, isn't it? But what it basically means is to put your faith in Jesus, that his blood was shed for you. His blood was shed so that you can be part of this great assembly, God's eternal, wonderful kingdom, to be cleansed from all of our sins so that we won't fall under his judgment, and instead to live under the shelter of his presence, to be with him, and to be free from all of that stuff that hurts us so much, that causes us pain and trial and agony on this earth in different ways, to be free, finally, from all of that. C.S. Lewis says in his book, The Great Divorce, that there is nothing that heaven, working backwards, cannot undo. That there is nothing in this life that it cannot heal. So just to sum it up, past, future, and present. Revelation is not a horror film. It's not meant to, for believers, it's not meant to terrify us. It's meant to encourage us. It is a blessing, as it says in chapter 1, after all, that we should take great heart from this. Whatever our present is, whatever we're going through at the moment, or may go through it one day, the future is beyond our imagination. The imagery is so complex that John couldn't describe it exactly, and neither could we. And even when we're suffering now, even in the midst of the very worst things, let's hold on to this revelation that we've been given. Keep in mind this picture in chapter 7, of one day being in this great multitude that will make everything finally worth it.